And welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at those times at richarddugan.com. The podcasts are available on the homepage as well as the radio shows page of richarddugan.com, as well as on SoundCloud, iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher. I'm trying to think if I'm forgetting anybody, and they're available, and we're trying to expand that list as well. So hope you'll check out those particular locations, and we'll let you know if there are others as well. It's great to have you with us here on the program each week, sharing information and ideas, concepts for those new ways of living that we're searching for in reference to those new paradigms, trying to give you health, wealth, and a wiser life, help you in your evolutionary process, as I am working on mine too. So we are certainly grateful for you joining us here on the program. Also, if you like what you're hearing, you'd like to support this radio broadcast, we are certainly open to that. We'd really appreciate it. We do have a PayPal account set up so that you can support this broadcast. And just so we don't get in trouble with the IRS, we are not nonprofit, so it is not tax deductible. Hopefully you're still interested in doing so, supporting us. Again, if you like what we're doing, you'd like to share in this particular vision, we are always very grateful for that. And we'll take energetic support as well. So thank you very much in advance for everything that you do, even in just listening to the program and sharing the ideas and thoughts of our guests. Speaking of guests today, we're going to have a woman who is on this program talking about something that, it's funny, when I read the title of the book, I couldn't help but think about this, and that was a line from, what was it, Buzz Lightyear, I guess it was Toy Story, Infinity and Beyond. This is sort of like that. It's actually Beyond the Mat is the title of the book. My guest is Dr. Julie Rosenberg. She is a pharmaceutical executive as well as a global healthcare leader. She's working to help people achieve optimal health, wealth, and life satisfaction through skills-based learning as well as personal leadership practices. And Julie, thank you so much for joining us here on the program. It's great to have you with us.
Hi, Richard. It's great to be here.
Now, for those who are not familiar, of course, probably not too many yet, but hopefully more will become familiar with this concept of Beyond the Mat, having to do with certainly one practice that I think at the condition that my physical body is in, I would have to be doing it in my mind. I would have to be imagining doing yoga in my mind, although I know that there are all kinds of different levels of yoga. But this is beyond that. Let's talk a little bit about the importance. I don't want to use the word necessity, although I suppose maybe you might, but the importance, the effectiveness that yoga can play in one's health and wealth and life satisfaction.
Yeah, so Richard, I think in the States, and we have a Western view of yoga that really folks look at it as primarily a fitness discipline. You know, they think about it as a series of physical poses in order to get fit and flexible. And while that is part of it, and I should mention to your earlier point of one's physical condition, there is something in yoga that really anyone who could move any part of their body could probably take advantage of. But nevertheless, it is not just a physical practice. It's really a practice of the body and mind, and it's composed of eight different limbs that help people draw their consciousness from our external focus. We're so focused on our external world, but to more of an internal focus, and helps us find a place of peace and satisfaction by having that broader internal focus. And I've always felt that the practice of yoga, and I am very Western trained, you know, in medicine and in my thinking living here in the United States for the whole of my life, I've always thought that this practice has helped me to think more clearly about options and opportunities, and also to reflect more carefully on who I am, where I am, my purpose in life, what I'm doing, and my impact on others. And so I think it really offers a very broad opportunity to optimize one's life, and that is why I wrote my book, Beyond the Mat, and I have to say today is the one-year anniversary of the book, so I'm so happy we're speaking today, and I've been really overjoyed that the book and the learnings from the book have helped so many people.
Well, I remember something similar. I was with my second wife, and we were still within the first few months, and she was very much involved in a particular practice, specifically Tai Chi, and the gentleman who was teaching her, we were all standing in the backyard and the music was playing and so forth. And I'd never done this stuff before, like different types of yoga. Now, my mother, growing up, she used to do Hatha yoga because she used to watch that on public television. But I'm standing there and I'm looking at everybody else and I'm trying to figure out what to do. And I'm trying to mimic and doing a lousy job of it. And finally, the instructor comes over and he says, "Don't worry about the movements. Just let the music carry you. Just flow with the music." Is yoga anything like that as far as flowing, or is there, for the most part, somewhat of a structure that is helpful to follow?
Well, I think what's most helpful in thinking about yoga is really for one to understand, first of all, that the practice is really, really a journey, and it's a study. It's understanding the discipline, and then it's a practice. And only part of that practice is a physical practice per se. So if I can just briefly go through the yoga discipline, there are eight limbs of Ashtanga yoga, the first being the yamas, and those are universal moral commandments or guidelines really for how we can best show up for our lives. And they apply to our actions, our thoughts, and our words. And they include such things like don't commit violence, tell the truth, don't steal, and things like this. And one could say that, you know, we hear this all the time, and maybe these things are known to us. But the practice really helps them be near and dear to our hearts and evolve in a way of living. The second limb of yoga is the niyama, and these are what we call self-purification by discipline, and that's kind of a lot of words, but they're practices such as cleanliness, contentment, self-restraint, self-study, and devotion. And these make up the niyama, and again, these are areas that we can study to really enhance our lives and our ways of thinking. The third limb is the asana, and these are the postures. And yes, there is a flow to yoga, but not all yoga requires the vinyasa or the flow. Again, there are simple things that I like to teach that folks can do at the desk. They can do them in an airplane. They can do them just seated at a movie, and they don't have to be totally involved, you know, like standing on your head. So that's the postures of yoga. And then the next limb is pranayama, and that's actually breath control. And so often in modern society, we forget about our breath, and we hold our breath. And sometimes just learning how to breathe and incorporating breathing will really help us calm down and pause in our day. And then beyond that is the next one is called pratyahara, and that is a liberation of our mind from the fact that our senses dominate so much that we do, and exterior objects dominate our thinking. It helps us move internally. And following that is a dharana, which is concentration, learning how to focus, learning how to concentrate. Dhyana is the seventh limb. This is meditation. We learn how to meditate, how to have an inward focus through meditation, and that allows us to have a more expansive awareness. And then the final limb is samadhi, and this is like the highest state in meditation where where one experiences sort of a oneness with the universe. And I think in modern times, we often can call this a flow. We're kind of in the groove. We're in the moment. We're in the flow, and we're really at our best. And I think just going through these limbs of yoga, of course, it's not an easy practice, and it's not an easy path. But thinking about this in a structure, I think, really helps us to live and to lead more optimally and allows us to be present with things that are so important in terms of how we may live and lead our lives. And that's why I like yoga so much. It's not even that I tell people, you know, go to the studio, go on a mat, do it this and that. It's really to allow a structure for people to live by and think by as they try to optimize their own experience and their experiences in relationship.
Now, it seems a little bit like these different legs, as you call them, of yoga, almost correspond to some degree with the chakras. Is that even close? I mean, I know some of this stuff, but it just seems like there are seven or eight legs there, and they kind of do tend to flow in that kind of direction.
Right, that is correct. And while I'm not personally an expert on the study of the chakras, yes, they do align quite well with the limbs of yoga. And there are many yoga practitioners and teachers that do study the chakras in depth. And again, though, Richard, what I'm trying to offer with taking the eight limbs of yoga, and of course, yoga is thousands and thousands of years old, I'm trying to put it in a modern day framework. And I'm trying to tell people that this doesn't have to cost you money. You know, we spend so much time and so much money doing things to improve our lives. And my premise is just that so much of this, quite frankly, is internal. It's our internal focus for ourselves, our ability to pause, to reflect, to really understand ourselves, to know what we want, to feel our emotions, and to really come to understand who we are. Because in our busy society today, we are so externally focused that these things are quite frankly, they're easy to forget.
Well, that's true enough. And I'm one of those who, you know, I do these programs on a regular basis, and we talk especially about meditation a lot of times. And, you know, I take the line from Teresa of Avila, who says that God is amongst the pots and the pans. So when I'm doing my work, that's kind of where I'm meditating. I'm going to find a time when I can go into my closet, so to speak. Beautiful thing is I have one of these sound booths in my home. And I can go in there and I can close the door and it's dark and it's quiet and so forth. And I know that with yoga, there is a certain element of, there are people who use this as not only the physical, mental and emotional, but it's a meditative type of thing as well.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And as I was mentioning, the seventh limb of yoga, the dhyana, is actually meditation. Mm-hmm. And you know, one thing that I think the listeners should take to heart is that one doesn't have to have a seated yoga practice or meditation practice for, you know, 20 or 30 minutes a day or twice a day. You know, we see people meditating or photos and people meditating, and we think, you know, can I really do this? Will I do it wrong? Can I sit that long? And you don't have to do that. I feel like what you said is so true, that we need to find moments to pause. And while everybody, you know, I don't have a sound booth, but I do a seated practice. But if we can just find a few moments to pause, to minimize our distractions, to focus on breathing, that's a very good focus for meditation. We don't have to necessarily worry about whether we're doing it correctly. It's really just practicing that ability to pause so we don't react so strongly when life within us or around us gets crazy. And this is where it's just so important, because we all face hectic issues and challenges in our lives. And what we need to do is strengthen our comfort level with those quiet moments, which ultimately will help us handle whatever comes our way and trust our abilities to manage those types of matters, whether they be big or small. So there's a huge value to meditation, and it's well beyond, you know, what one does in a studio. It's really what happens in the day, you know, in the move of each person flowing or moving through their day.
Well, I know that I've seen a lot of folks practicing it, and there's also another. It's not part of this particular list of the eight legs, but it is a sort of new. Actually, there are two of them. One that I personally will not participate in because I moved away from Phoenix to get away from it, and that's what they call hot yoga, which is done in a very hot room. But there's also this new one called goat yoga. Are you familiar with that one at all?
If you're talking about literally yoga with goats or with animals, I am familiar with this, and I actually do mention this in my book: yoga with cats, yoga with dogs, yoga with goats, yoga with farm animals. I mean, you know, it's really been expanded to all sorts of things, which quite frankly, they're a bit beyond my scope. But I don't know, Richard, is that something you've tried?
No.
Goat yoga?
No, I have not. Although I've heard that it is really very interesting, but I will say that just the aspect of incorporating an animal into your life, just period, whether it's with yoga or what have you, that is a very profound thing. I mean, they're even saying, I mean, there are scientific studies that have been done that have shown that if you have a pet, you know, or an animal in your life in some way, shape, or form, it can add years to your life. It will help to lower your blood pressure. Although we've had cats and dogs and chickens and turkeys and all of that, and for some reason my blood pressure is still a little on the high side. But what's nice is that when we go home, we're heading up to all of these wonderful creatures. But just having them in one's life can go a long way. So if you're using them in your practice, in your yoga practice, I'd say that can go a long way.
Yeah, you know, for me, one of the things about yoga is to really act without judgment. And so while this is not standard in yoga, I think whatever works for a person is what they should do. But on the line of pets, it's definitely true, and especially with cats and dogs, that pets not only improve your happiness, but they can improve your health. And like you were mentioning, a pet is really good for so many things. They help you lower stress. They help people with depression. They connect you to a community of other like-minded people. And one other thing, especially with a dog, you know, dogs have to typically get out and be walked. And so they get you moving, because we are in a sedentary society, and moving is just so important of any type. So I'm a big fan. I've only had dogs personally, but I'm a big fan of pets, and quite frankly, the proof is in the science of their overarching value for people and for communities.
Well, I know that, and I have to say that I want to mention this, and that is that during the at the time of our conversation here, you know, we're in the process of remembering our 41st president, and there was a scene that has been that went viral and I did not know he had a service animal named Sully, and there was supposedly a tweet or what have you, some mention on Facebook or something by someone who said, well, you know, they were criticizing the dog because they said the dog isn't really sitting here thinking, how the hell do you know? What are you talking? You know. We just don't understand animals the way that we could. And that's one of the things that I have learned as a dog owner, cat owner. When an animal does something, it's not our responsibility to step in and correct them. It's our responsibility to figure out why they're doing what they're doing, because they're not doing it for no reason at all. Whereas we, as human beings, it seems like we're doing stuff for no reason at all sometimes. It's sometimes can be kind of chaotic. And I'm thinking that yoga, in this instance, can go a long way. I know that you're also involved in the pharmaceutical industry, correct?
Yes, I have worked in oversight roles to develop new drugs for patients with cancer. I believe you know my background training and certifications are as a pediatric oncologist, but I have worked in the pharmaceutical industry for about 13 years with this focus in mind. You know, it's patient service through developing new drugs, and that can be a pretty rigorous role, and that's really how I first came into a lot of this, trying to best manage my time and handle many of the challenges that came my way, and I'll tell you, it worked, you know, and so I'm coming from that Western background with a lot of challenges in my work world, my personal world, and I'm very confident that this works for me. Mm-hmm. And the feedback that I've gotten, of course, following the launch of my book, is that it's worked very well for other people to sort of structure their life and their thinking in this way.
Dr. Julie Rosenberg is my guest. The book that she's referring to is Beyond the Mat, and we encourage you to pick up a copy. I'm curious about something also, Doctor, and that is, there was a study, and it was actually documented, if you will, on, I think it was a 60 Minutes piece, or maybe it was another documentary, having to do with the value of what's called the placebo effect. And this is what was so fascinating to me was, normally, when you use a placebo, you have two test groups, a minimum, obviously, and one group gets the actual medication, the chemicals, and the other one gets a placebo, maybe a sugar pill, something like that. But they're not told. Well, in this particular study, the group that was getting the placebo was told they were getting the placebo, and they actually had positive results, as if they were taking the actual medication. Can you talk a little bit about that? Is that in your purview?
Well, I can, because I run drug development, you know, programs. But just to say overall, is that the mind can have a very powerful influence on the body. And in some cases, it can even help the body heal. So if you believe that a fake treatment, in this case a placebo, if you can believe that such a treatment has, or not, has real therapeutic benefits, this phenomenon that's known as the placebo effect does occur. And sometimes placebos can actually exert an influence powerful enough to nearly mimic the effects of a true medical treatment. And I think this has been studied, you know, by psychologists and scientists. And there really is a search to better understand the physiological and psychological effects known as the placebo effect and why it works. But good example of mind over matter.
Mm. And I would think then that yoga, in all of its different facets, could go a long way to help to support something along those lines. I'm not necessarily advocating that let's get rid of all of the medications and just use placebos, but hey, if you can train your mind to accept that this is something that can help you, you know, who knows? Wasn't it, was it Dr. Norman Vincent Peale who was diagnosed with some terminal disease and was told he had 6 months to live, and he said no, and actually used laughter as a way of healing himself, and actually, I guess, lived several more years after.
Yeah, I'll tell you, laughter is a very good way of, coping with things. We probably don't have enough laughter in our lives today, Richard. Mm-hmm. But yes, I mean, laughter is a very good way of just managing challenging situations. It's very good to laugh, and it's good to find humor, especially when you know, we ourselves might do things that are a little silly or challenging, rather than criticizing ourselves, you know, find the humor in the situation. But it is absolutely true that yoga has scientifically been found to be very adjunctive to treatment for serious disease. So, as you mentioned, it's not a replacement for medical treatment, but there have been a number of studies, probably the most of them have been with women with breast cancer, showing that, you know, patients are more settled with their disease. They cope better with treatment and beyond treatment. And also that it's really value added for the longer term in terms of their physicality and flexibility. And yoga can be modified, as I said earlier in our talk, pretty much for any type of condition. As long as a person can move their body, there are things that folks can do. For example, you know, we can all, if we're sitting at a desk during the day, we can all do some back stretches or some neck stretches or some seated twists, all of which I discuss in the book. They're simple poses that can really help us just to feel better. And when we feel better, we perform better. And that's what I'm saying. I mean, it's really a value add in so many circumstances to think this way and also to do some of the smaller physical practices.
What was it that introduced you to yoga?
Actually, my life has really revolved for so many years around fitness practices. I always felt that running and working out in the gym, cycling and things like this, they were such a value add to my life in terms of just how I felt and how I moved through the day. But as my career expanded and as I experienced more challenges in my own life, including the fact that my son is autistic and we were raising a child with special needs at a time that I was really quite engaged in my career and trying to also focus on my family as well, and probably not anything, you know, different than so many of our listeners today. During that time, what I myself was lacking somewhat in just primarily managing my health through nutrition and fitness practices was the ability to truly manage my stress and the ability to slow down and pause. And so through a variety of inquiries that I made, I got involved with yoga, and I found it so compelling that I went on to a 200-hour teacher training and then later an advanced teacher training, so I really would have a deep understanding of the discipline and the practice. And through those advanced training years, I really developed this framework where I have applied these principles and practice to so many things that go on in modern times, making them available and relevant to most anyone. And initially, I have to mention, my audience was primarily going to be sort of a corporate audience, you know, higher tiered professionals that really had difficulty managing stress and were at risk for burnout. But as time has gone on, you know, the work is just so applicable to most anyone, because no matter what our role in life is, we are predisposed to stress, and stress, if left untended, can really wreak havoc on our bodies, minds, and hearts. So this framework really could be adopted by just about anyone and enhance their life.
It's very interesting, because I know that a lot of people are looking for ways in which they can do just that, enhance their lives, and again, have that more satisfying life. We talk a lot on this program about moving from a survival mode to thrival mode. And that, I think, this can really go a long way for our listeners to achieve their highest state of well-being, build resilience, handle stress, as you just mentioned. And obviously, in my case, it raises the old blood pressure with too much stress, increasing stamina, enhance focus strategies and leadership, improving overall wellness. I want to come back when we come back from break and talk to you about that aspect of the work that you do, and that is having to do with leaders and leadership here on the program, okay?
Sure.
I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, new Paradigms for a New World, and we are talking with Julie Rosenberg, and she's the author of Beyond the Mat. JulieRosenbergMD.com is the website, JulieRosenbergMD.com. We will be linked to her website. We encourage you to go there and check it out. Also, if you're listening to this interview on the radio broadcast, you're going to want to go to the podcast and listen to the entire interview. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we'll be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Thanks for staying with us, along with my special guest, Julie Rosenberg. Beyond the Mat is the title of the book. JulieRosenbergMD.com is the website. And I wanted to ask you, you have actually a little quiz up on your website having to do with leadership. And I wanted to find out, from your perspective, why is that so important, and maybe especially in our day and age, to cultivate leaders? What characteristics are we looking for in these leaders? Do we have a crop of potential leaders that will really actually serve us, in that sense? Because from my perspective as a leader, operations manager, I've had staff under me, I have never lorded that. In my early career, I mean, in the first year or two, I took on what I referred to as a Hitlerian attitude. I found that didn't work real well. What I found worked really well was that I put myself at their level, because I was doing the same job they were doing. And that seemed to make all the difference in the world. If I was willing to clean the toilet, usually the staff was willing to do the same because they saw that I was doing it too. So talk to us a little bit about this aspect of leadership and those characteristics that are needed.
Right. So one of the things that I'm very interested in is the development of what I call highly effective leaders or enlightened leaders. And first and foremost, I think that our listeners should really be aware that leaders aren't necessarily those who are in the C-suite or who have high-level jobs. You know, I personally believe that anyone can be a leader and anyone can be an enlightened leader. And to your point, I do have a quiz on my website about enlightened leadership. You know, are you an enlightened leader? And basically, what I believe enlightened leaders are committed to is to making the world a better place. And they are committed to ongoing personal growth and transformation. And I define enlightened leaders in several different ways. But basically, I believe that they are people who are compassionate, confident, courageous, humble, intentional, open-minded, passionate, purposeful, self-aware, self-caring, spiritual, and visionary. And I just went through that sort of long list because I think if we have aspects of all these various components, we really reach a state of harmony with our well-being and in our ability to serve others. And so in that list, there's nothing about, okay, you need to be a vice president or a senior vice president of a company, or in your case, Richard, an operations manager. In my case, I'm a global development lead. You know what? That's a high-level term or whatever for what someone does. And I agree with you 100%. Rolling up your sleeves and really understanding and participating in what the people do, but being able to take maybe that next step that requires courage or requires some visionary thinking, you know, to truly lead a group or lead a company or in government or what have you. I think that these things still need to be tempered by different characteristics that allow us to interface with others as successfully as possible. And so when we can do these things, we really become what I'm terming enlightened leaders. And I do go through that, of course, in some depth in my book. And anyone can be a leader. And I feel like this is what people really need to understand. My focus is not just on corporate leadership or leadership of others, but it starts with the one. It starts with each of ourselves. How we lead ourselves will be tantamount to how we lead others.
You know, one of the observations that I have had over the years of leaders, whether it be corporate or political, has been, especially with corporate leaders who get these humongous bonuses, what did you do to earn that bonus? What in the world did you achieve in that position that the people who actually are working down in the trenches, whether it be retail and they're there at the cash register and in those brick and mortar stores meeting the customers, to me, those are the ones who should be getting the bonuses, not the guy at the very top. I can't understand how that person does that. And then when you come to political leaders, and again, this is based upon what I have heard in the last few days of the memorialization of George Bush 41. Based upon all of the descriptions of that man, he's the kind of guy that I would certainly want as president, because he's put the plastic bag on his hand and picked up the poop from his dogs. He has picked up a shovel and he's dug a hole to plant a tree. He has done all of these dirty jobs that a lot of these politicians who want to serve the public and claim that they have a connection to the public, he's the only one I can think of off the top of my head right now who's done that. Who's got dirt under his fingernails over the years. A lot of these guys have never even looked at a shovel, except maybe online. You know, and I often wonder, you want to serve? Well, you know, I want you to, you know, go to this kennel and clean it. You know, show me that you are one of us. And that's one of the hardest things, I think, for a lot of us in the public to acknowledge, is that some of these people have lost touch. Some of the leaders that we have right now have lost touch with, the only way I can phrase it, is the common man. What are your thoughts in that regard? And we're not necessarily naming specific individuals, but just in general. I mean, we can go back 40, 50, 60 years, and we start to see this transition from the hard worker who works his way or her way up the corporate or political ladder, who's gotten dirt under their fingernails, to people today who have that privilege and they just somehow are groomed for those positions.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, I don't know if we can solve some of the challenges that you're pointing out in corporate structures. Certainly it does occur. This type of disparity does occur, especially in a number of large organizations. But I think back to your comment about Bush 41, I might just take that a step further, because I think there's a real value add. You know, Bush used to talk about 1,000 points of life in a kindler, gentler nation. And I think that his characteristics, his personal characteristics, usually would emulate that. And while he was just a one-term president, I think that much of his legacy will go down in history for this idea of rolling up your sleeves, as you've mentioned, and the concept of the kinder, gentler nation, which certainly in modern days we've gotten away from. And I think, as a last gift of service, if you will, it's very clear that at today's ceremony memorializing former president, you know, George H.W. Bush, all of the living presidents and their spouses are in attendance. And I think that is an act of gratitude and kindness, especially since, you know, the current president certainly has not been very kind, at least publicly in the past, to either the deceased president or his son, George W. Bush. So I believe that through observation and through practice, we can get back to this idea of a kinder, gentler nation, but we really have gotten away from it with the level of disruption, if you will, that's not been necessarily positive, and some of the chaos and turmoil we've seen in recent times with our government. So I do appreciate, you know, what has transpired today, and that today is a national day of mourning, so that all of us can really reflect on this.
Yeah. And I think that's a very good thing. I think that the timing is so appropriate. You know, we have no clue as to how the timing clock works. The universe does, and obviously this was the time for this. And you know, certainly he will be missed. But at the same time, as it also been said, he's now with his wife as well as his daughter that he lost many, many years ago. This aspect of leadership is very interesting, and I don't know if you made the implication that some of these characteristics they can be taught, or do you really? It's like common sense. I say this quite often. You know, you can't teach common sense. But what about these aspects of leadership? These aspects of character, as they say, are these things that a person can acquire, or do they have to be born with them?
No, I do believe that these things are acquired, and you know, like the practice of yoga, leadership itself is really a practice. And you know, you were mentioning, and I'm sure it's a bit tongue in cheek, but you were saying that, you know, you sort of had your own Hitlerian type of approach to things
years ago.
Yeah, and I think, you know, what we learn, right? We learn that things like that don't work. You know, usually being a strictly autocratic type of a leader, that just doesn't work. But I think when we come to know, and it's an internal knowing about the things that are really critical on what some would call the soft signs, you know, this idea of being compassionate and self-aware and self-caring and maybe more spiritual, these things do come with time. And other aspects of character, you know, I think these too can be learned, like courage, humility, and being more intentional and purposeful. But it is a dedication, as well as it requires not only that, but a self-reflection to ensure that, you know, this is really who I am, and this is what I want, and this is how I will lead myself and others. And it's a practice. I mean, you know, I myself, you know, work to develop many of these characteristics. Some I probably have a little more innately, or their stronger strengths, but others, you know, I really have to work on. And so I think that's probably true for all of us.
Mm. Well, it is something that, you know, we're all working on. One of the leadership qualities that I've tried to develop, and that is to share everything that I know with everybody who I work with. Because if I hold on to it, if I hoard it, if I don't share it with other people, then I get stuck and I don't get to do other stuff. And I've always wanted to do that. So I don't have a... it's not to say that there haven't been instances where, you know, my ego was a little bruised when they've taken certain tasks away from me. But then I had to take a look at that. Okay, well, now that's not mine anymore. So now I can go and pursue something else. I can learn something else in another direction. And that kind of helped to soften the blow a little bit. But I've always found that, you know, not to have a turf, you know what I'm saying? Not to protect my turf,
you know? No, understood. And, you know, none of us can be an expert at everything, right?
Yeah.
And sharing our knowledge, and for me, you know, just watching people grow by that information share, and seeing teams grow together, This is just so satisfying because I really believe that our legacy is so tied to our impact on people and not just what we do, right? So how we will be remembered is really going to be by that impact, by what we offered, by how we served. And I think, again, it's going to be those intangibles that matter so much. So I'm certainly aligned with that idea of, you know, sharing as much of what I know as is appropriate and as is possible with others.
Yeah. This is very interesting. Julie Rosenberg, Dr. Julie Rosenberg is my guest. JulieRosenbergMD.com is the website. Beyond the Mat is the title of the book. We encourage you to go to that website. We are linked to it as well so that you can continue your educational process. The concept of yoga has become so mainstream, and what it reminds me of is back in the late 70s and early 80s in particular, how chiropractic was, you know, woo-woo, and the insurance companies wanted nothing to do with it and so on and so forth, and now it's mainstream, along with acupuncture, acupressure, and so many other modalities for people to improve their health. Tell me a little bit about the aspect, because it's mentioned in some of the information and I'm sure discussed in the book as well, about not just helping to improve your health and wellness, but also the word wealth was used. Talk to us a little bit about that aspect. How does it help us in our prosperity and abundance?
Well, I think, you know, the first and foremost, I mean, in my opinion, the first part of wealth is really related to self-care and health, because no matter how much money one makes, you cannot enjoy it if you're ill. But the other thing with yoga as well is I think the idea of purposeful living is really a strong part of it. And I think when we are able to do and move in a way that's purposeful and that allows us to explore our passions, oftentimes abundance does come more readily, because all of us have probably had some kind of job or something to do that we really just didn't like. We weren't fully engaged, we didn't do our best, and we may not have made, you know, much money by doing it. And so it really, in addition to the focus on self-care and the physicality of things and the wellness, I feel like the wealth can come from more purposeful leading and living and coming to a place where one can really explore passions and opportunities that make the most sense and will bring you the most satisfaction.
And that's a big deal, in my opinion, today, is satisfaction. I keep hearing the employment numbers. You know, they're supposedly getting better and better every day. And I wonder, well, what jobs are being created? And then they're saying, of course, that there aren't enough skilled workers to fill all the jobs that are available. But I remember in 2008, when we had that, you know, I don't know whether it was a recession or a depression. I don't know what they call it. But, you know, thousands and thousands of people lost their jobs. And the first thing that came to mind was, I wonder how many of those people hated their jobs. And then, of course, there has been since then a big boom in entrepreneurial ventures, individuals who are now sort of pursuing that dream that they had of instead of following in mom or grandpa's or great grandpa's footsteps of working in the factory, they wanted to do something else. I'm wondering about that aspect of actually what's being called sort of the search for, if you will, or pursuit, as in our Declaration of Independence, a pursuit of happiness. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I think people are really focused more and more on this concept of happiness. And for each person, you know, it needs to be defined for them. What does it mean? What does it look like? And again, this goes back to my comments about spirituality and also, you know, self-awareness. What does this look like for you, happiness? And I think, you know, we all should try to do meaningful work. And meaningful work for one person isn't going to be the same as for another person. But if the work gives us purpose, meaning, and satisfaction, we're likely going to do better at it, and we're going to stay with it longer. So I really applaud people that have worked, you know, in an entrepreneurial way and really set up things that are successful. And while, of course, there's no guarantee to success, I think that foundation of purpose, passion, meaning, and having some vision, that foundation serves many, many people. And then, you know, the rest will follow with appropriate support. I myself, as another example, have really enjoyed for a long time, you know, working in corporate settings. But I'm also moving more and more to where I might be able to serve in more of an entrepreneurial fashion by doing what you said, you know, sharing my learnings with others through more consulting and public speaking and more writing, because that's really what I've seen, you know, drives me, drives my spirit, drives my soul, and how I'd like to go forward in the next number of years. And so I mentioned that, and that these things can change, because I really loved corporate work for many, many years. And then I started thinking, well, maybe I could serve better by doing something else. And so I think this is what I'd encourage, you know, folks to do, to think about, you know, where is your time best spent? And then just one more comment in general about the job situation. You know, everybody is not going to have a job that necessarily brings them the greatest meaning and value. But if whatever that job is, if it supports the whole of your life in achieving the meaning and value that you seek, it can be a very positive part of your life, even if it in and of itself doesn't bring you the greatest satisfaction you might ever seek. And so it's always how we look at things and how we internalize them and how we put them, you know, into the framework of our lives.
Absolutely. Let me ask you about man's evolution. What role do you see yoga playing in our evolutionary process, and maybe where do you see us maybe in 100 or 1,000 years if we incorporate some of these ancient teachings and philosophies into our lives?
Well, I'm not sure, obviously, of what the course of evolution will be, but you know, it's certainly is something cool to speculate about, right? I feel like we would be, back to George H.W. Bush, we would probably be a kinder and gentler nation if we spent more time on some of these things like self-restraint, contentment, studying ourselves, you know, having greater insight and self-awareness, and also really following, you know, the moral commandments, where we're not committing violence against others. You know, there's so much violence, especially gun violence now in America. You know, we need to tell the truth, not taking what others have. And these kind of basic things that seem to be self-evident, unfortunately, in so many ways, we've lost sight of this as a society. So I think that the practice of yoga, the adoption of yoga, will lead us to a situation of more groundedness and perhaps more opportunity and perhaps also more collegiality and positivity in relationships kind of across the board, including, you know, in our political forums and other areas where there might be some unrest at the current time. So I would want all of that, you know, for society as we move forward. How much of it will truly be adopted, it's hard to know, but I see my job and my goal as raising awareness about these opportunities and helping to promote them in whatever way I can.
What has been the most surprising thing that you have learned about yourself through this process?
I think probably what I've learned about myself, Richard, is how much I love the writing life. I really enjoyed writing Beyond the Mat. In the past, most of what I had written was for the medical literature. I participated in many, many scientific studies, and I'd written a lot of review articles and articles about the outcomes of these various studies over many years. And I really enjoyed sitting down in quietude and being creative and thinking about how I might actually help others and change society through the written word, and taking that obviously a step further beyond the written word. Of course, is things like what you and I are doing today, podcasts and lectures and the like. I think being able to influence people in a positive way through these various things, such as writing and speaking, is really, really important to me now. And I would say 10 years ago, it wasn't something that was on top of mind.
Julie Rosenberg, I want to thank you so much for giving us so much time here on the program, sharing us your story and the work that you're doing, and the book, of course, entitled Beyond the Mat, and JulieRosenbergMD.com is the website. And should you find yourself out here on the Central Coast anytime in the near future, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. I think this is most beneficial for all of us to at least consider. And there are so many different forms of yoga that we're going to find one that works for us.
That's true, Richard, and thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure talking to you and sharing some time with your listening audience.
I have three final questions for you, and you've probably answered them in some way, shape, or form throughout the interview, but I'd like to ask them directly just the same. And the first question is, who is Julie Rosenberg?
So I am a physician and a pediatric oncologist by background and training. I've worked in the pharmaceutical industry, but now I'm evolving my career to more consultation with drug development, and also consultation and coaching around conscious leadership and ways to ensure long-term well-being and sustainable success.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
I'd like to see a society where people have greater ownership of their health and well-being, and I'd like to be able to be on the forefront of helping them do this in creative ways and in ways that are actually sustainable and enjoyable.
And what is your life's purpose?
I think my purpose is to help people through challenging times with disease as a physician, but also in service to their health ownership, to their wellness, and to their well-being. Whatever I can do to promote on an individual and societal level a greater well-being, that's what I'd like to do.
Again, Dr. Julie Rosenberg, thank you so much for joining us here on the program.
Thank you, Richard. Be well.
And you too. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.